3.8%, compared to a consensual per-incident rate of only 3.1%. This finding can be partially explained by selection bias in the victims whom rapists target, young, fertile women. Nonetheless, even controlling for age, the study's authors find a rape pregnancy rate that is roughly 2% higher than the consensual sex pregnancy rate. This counterintuitive finding, if it turns out to be replicable, cries out for some kind of explanation. Jonathan and Tiffany Gottschall offer a hypothesis anchored in the premise that men who court women using normal mating strategies are at the mercy of discriminating females, whereas rapists are not. Rapists, although constrained by opportunity and the defense mechanisms of women, nonetheless can and do choose victims who would otherwise refuse to mate with them. Rapists might choose women who, in addition to being young, are especially physically attractive. Since attractive women are more fertile on average, see Chapter 3, this may partially explain the unusually high rape pregnancy rate. The rape pregnancy findings, however, do not directly support the rape as adaptation hypothesis. We already know that men are attracted to features that correlate with fertility, such as cues to youth and health, in consensual mating contexts. And so, no specialized rape adaptation is required to explain these results. The rape pregnancy findings do, however, contradict the so-called argument from inconceivable conception, according to which some opponents of the rape as adaptation theory claim that rape cannot possibly have evolved because it so rarely leads to conception. Individual men differ in their proclivity toward rape. In one study, men were asked to imagine that they had the possibility of forcing sex on someone else against her will, with no chance of getting caught, no chance that anyone would find out, no risk of disease, and no possibility of damage to their reputation. 35% indicated that there was some likelihood they would force sex on the woman under these conditions, although in most cases, the likelihood was slight. In another study that used a similar method, 27% of the men indicated that there was some likelihood they would force sex on a woman if there was no chance of getting caught. Although these percentages are alarmingly high, if taken at face value, they also indicate that most men are not potential rapists. Men who do use coercion to get sex exhibit a distinct set of characteristics. They tend to be hostile toward women, to endorse the myth that women secretly want to be raped, and to show a personality profile marked by impulsiveness, hostility, low agreeableness, low empathy, and hyper-masculinity, combined with a high degree of sexual promiscuity. Marital rapes are more likely when the husband is concerned about a potential sexual infidelity, as well as during or immediately following a breakup. This finding suggests the possibility of rape as a sperm competition adaptation. Nonetheless, the direction of causality is unclear. Perhaps women are more likely to break up with partners who tend to force them into unwanted sex. In short, a conclusion reached by Donald Simons in 1979 appears to be apt today. I do not believe that available data are even close to sufficient to warrant the conclusion that rape itself is a facultative adaptation in the human male. I speculate that scientific progress will advance when theorists distinguish different types of rape rather than viewing sexual assault as a singular crime. Consider date rape, stranger rape, warfare rape, rape by husbands, homosexual rape, and rape of stepdaughters by stepfathers. The causes of one type of rape may differ substantially from the causes of others. Date rape, for example, may be partly a byproduct of the modern conditions of living, where young women live in social circumstances devoid of the close protection of extended kin, a known deterrent to violence against women. Serial stranger rapists often manage to avoid detection owing to the unusual modern conditions of high geographic mobility and anonymous urban living. The limited geographical mobility and small group living of our ancestors would have rendered certain kinds of stranger rape virtually impossible. Rape in the context of warfare, in contrast, appears to have a cross-cultural prevalence and historical depth that may have favored selections for rape. Some kinds of rape may be caused by pathology or dysfunction of evolved mechanisms. Others may be byproducts. Still others may be caused by specific rape adaptations. Lumping all instances of forced sex under a single label, rape, may impede progress in discovering the unique underlying causal conditions that lead to each distinct type of crime. Do women have evolved sexual assault defenses? The feminist author Susan Griffin has written, "I have never been free of the fear of rape. From a very early age, I, like most women, have thought of rape as part of my natural environment, something to be feared and prayed against like fire or lightning. I never asked why men raped. I simply thought of it as one of the many mysteries of human nature." Although the controversy over the scientific study of rape has focused primarily on what motivates men to force sex on women, almost lost in the furor is attention to the psychology of rape victims. There is one point about victim psychology, however, on which all sides of the debate agree. Rape is an abhorrent atrocity that typically inflicts heavy costs on victims. We need no formal theory to arrive at this insight. Nonetheless, it is important to determine why rape is experienced as extraordinarily traumatic. From an evolutionary perspective, the costs of rape begin with the fact that it circumvents female choice, a core component of women's sexual strategy. A raped woman risks untimely pregnancy with a man she has not chosen, a man who imposes himself against her will, a man who is unlikely to invest in her children, and a man who may have genes inferior to those she would otherwise have chosen. A raped woman risks being blamed, punished, or abandoned by her regular mate, who may suspect that her experience was consensual or that she somehow brought it on herself. The costs of being raped are dramatically illustrated in a case in Pakistan. Zafran Bibi, a 26-year-old devout Muslim residing in Pakistan, was sentenced to death by stoning. Her crime was adultery, punishable by death according to Islamic law. The evidence, a child born more than a year after her husband had abandoned her, but had not yet divorced her. This was no ordinary adultery. Zafran Bibi had been raped by her brother-in-law, she testified. That did not matter. The birth of the illegitimate child proved adultery, according to the judge. Her accusation that her brother-in-law had raped her was tantamount to a criminal confession. Raped women suffer psychologically. They experience fear, humiliation, embarrassment, anxiety, depression, rage, and fury. They feel guilty, used, violated, and polluted. Women view forced sex as more upsetting to them than any of at least 147 other things that a man can do to hurt a woman. More upsetting even than savage, non-sexual beatings at the hands of a man. Raped women also suffer in the aftermath. Some victims fear leaving their houses, avoid contact with men, isolate themselves socially, and live in a psychological prison with no apparent reprieve. On top of the psychological torment, raped women suffer socially. As the case of Zafran Bibi illustrates, victims are sometimes held responsible for the crime perpetrated on them. They experience damage to their reputations. They suffer a loss in perceived desirability on the mating market. Their kin may reject or ostracize them for bringing shame on their family. They sometimes become socially shunned. Whatever the causes of rape, no one except the clueless and calloused doubts the appalling damage it inflicts on the victim. Given these often catastrophic costs, if rape has occurred throughout human history, it would defy evolutionary logic if selection had not fashioned defenses in women to prevent its occurrence. This is a separate issue from that of whether men have evolved adaptations to rape. Women could have evolved anti-rape adaptations in principle even if rape has been entirely a byproduct of non-rape mechanisms. We can never determine with absolute certainty whether rape was frequent enough historically to have forged a female anti-rape psychology, but we can assemble available historical and cross-cultural evidence to make an educated guess. Written history, dating back to the Bible, brims with episodes of rape, and even specifications by religious leaders about the conditions under which men can sexually assault women. For example, the Sages of the Talmud, codified by Maimonides, provides this injunction. A soldier in the invading army may, if overpowered by passion, cohabit with a captive woman, but he is forbidden to cohabit a second time before he marries her. Coition with her is permitted only at the time when she is taken captive. He must not force her in the open field of battle, that is, he shall take her to a private place and cohabit with her. Although no systematic studies have been conducted on the occurrence and frequency of rape among traditional societies across cultures, an informal review of published ethnographies reveals that rape is reported in many of them, from the Amazonian jungle of Brazil to the more peaceful Kungsan of Botswana. The Simai of central Malaysia were frequently victimized by Malay raiders, who would ambush them, kill the men, and take the women by force. The Amazonian peoples studied by Thomas Greger have special words for both rape, antapai, and gang rape, antiawakakinapai. Rapes in war occurred as far back as there are written records, as amply documented by Susan Brownmiller in her classic treatise Against Our Will. Genghis Khan, more than 800 years ago, talked with relish about the gratification received through rape. The greatest pleasure in life is to vanquish your enemies and chase them before you, to rob them of their wealth and see those dear to them bathed in tears, to ride their horses, and to clasp to your bosom their wives and daughters. The evolutionary anthropologist Barbara Smuts summarizes the cross-cultural evidence in this way. Although the prevalence of male violence against women varies from place to place, cross-cultural surveys indicate that societies in which men rarely attack or rape women are the exception, not the norm. A number of evolutionary scientists have been at the forefront in articulating potential evolved defenses against rape. Hypothesized anti-rape adaptations include psychological pain upon rape that motivates avoiding rape in the future, formation of alliances with males as special friends for protection, formation of female-female coalitions for protection, specialized fears that motivate women to avoid situations in which they might be in danger of rape, and the shunning of risky activities during ovulation to decrease the odds of sexual assault when conception is most likely. The first clue to the possibility that women have evolved adaptations to prevent being raped comes from two studies that analyzed the distribution of rapes across the female menstrual cycle. In one study of 785 rape victims, proportionately fewer women were raped during mid-cycle, defined as days 10 to 22, an unfortunately wide and hence imprecise interval. Another study found that ovulating women were less often victims of sexual assault. To explore these patterns, Tara Chavon and Gordon Gallup studied risk-taking among 300 undergraduate women. Women indicated whether they had engaged in each of 18 activities that varied in their risk of making someone vulnerable to sexual assault. Going to church and watching television were examples of low-risk activities. Going to a bar and walking in a dimly lit area were examples of high-risk activities. For women taking birth control pills, Chavon and Gallup find no effect of menstrual cycle on risk-taking. Among women not taking the pill, however, ovulating women showed a decrease in risk-taking activities. Contending that risk avoidance is a candidate for an anti-rape adaptation, these authors successfully rule out several alternative explanations for the reduction in risk-taking. For example, this reduction in risk-taking is not a reflection of diminished sexual receptivity at ovulation. In fact, women usually peak in sexual motivation and receptivity at mid-cycle when they are with a consenting partner. Mid-cycle risk avoidance also cannot be attributed to a decrease in women's general activity level, since pedometer-recorded activity level in women tends to increase during ovulation. In short, ovulating women appear to avoid behaviors that put them at increased risk of rape, suggesting the possibility of specialized risk avoidance as an anti-rape adaptation. Many women routinely engage in risk avoidance maneuvers to avoid putting themselves in harm's way. In one study of urban women, 41% reported isolation tactics, such as not going out on the streets at night, and 71% reported using street-savvy tactics, such as wearing shoes that would enable them to run away should they be attacked. In a study in Seattle, 67% of women said that they avoided certain dangerous locations of the city. 42% reported not going out unaccompanied, and 27% sometimes refused to answer their door. A study of Greek women reported that 71% avoided venturing out alone at night, and 78% shunned dangerous locations within the city. Women also show wariness around men who talk about sex a lot, men who are sexually aggressive, and men who have a reputation for sleeping with a lot of women. Women report choosing public places for dates with men they do not know well. They intentionally avoid giving mixed sexual signals to certain men. They sometimes carry pepper spray, mace, whistles, or weapons. And they sometimes limit their drinking around men they do not know well. These risk avoidance strategies may be learned prudence measures, much like installing a burglar alarm after reading about a rash of burglaries in the neighborhood. Alternatively, risk avoidance may be motivated in part by a specialized fear of rape, a second potential anti-rape adaptation that induces women to avoid contexts conducive to sexual assault. Evidence for this specialized fear comes from a strong positive association between women's reports of rape fear and their reports of how many different behavioral precautions they are taking to avoid rape. Women who are fearful of rape, more than women who are less fearful, avoid being alone with men they do not know well, decline rides from men, leave when a man comes on too strong sexually, avoid outdoor activities when alone, and exercise caution in their drinking. One New Zealand study found that young women experience more fear of sexual assault than older women. Older women's fears were more likely to center on being robbed or burgled than on being raped. Women residing in neighborhoods with a high incidence of rape report more fear than those living in safer neighborhoods. These studies, of course, cannot determine whether women have evolved a specialized fear of rape contingent on their age and vulnerability, or whether these fears are expressions of more general mechanisms, such as a rational appraisal of danger combined with fear mechanisms possessed by all people. The psychologists Susan Hickman and Charlene Muellenhard found that women were more fearful of being raped by strangers than by acquaintances. This difference occurred despite the fact that stranger rape is rare, accounting for only 10 to 20% of all rapes, compared with acquaintance rape, which is far more common, roughly 80 to 90%. Hickman and Muellenhard conclude that women's fears do not match the realities of rape. An alternative interpretation is that women's apprehensions are actually effective. Stranger fear motivates precautionary behaviors, lowering the real incidence of stranger rape below what it would have been without these functional fears. According to this view, women's stranger fears function to prevent rape. Alternatively, women's fear of stranger rape could have evolved in ancestral environments, in warfare contexts, in which rapists were, in fact, mostly strangers, very much unlike the modern environment. These hypotheses could both be partially true, and both remain to be empirically tested. Sarah Messnick and Margot Wilson have explored a third potential anti-rape adaptation, which they call the bodyguard hypothesis. According to this hypothesis, women form heterosexual pair bonds with men in part to reduce their risk of sexual aggression from other men. According to the bodyguard hypothesis, women should be especially attracted to physically large and socially dominant men in contexts in which they are at risk of sexual aggression. To test the bodyguard hypothesis, Wilson and Messnick studied 12,252 women, each interviewed over the phone by trained female interviewers. Questions about sexual assault began with, "Has a male stranger ever forced you or attempted to force you into any sexual activity by threatening you, holding you down, or hurting you in some way?" Subsequent questions dealt with unwanted sexual touching. "Apart from this incident you have just told me about, has a male stranger ever touched you against your will in any sexual way, such as unwanted touching, grabbing, kissing, or fondling?" The statistical analysis focused on sexual victimization that had occurred within the 12 months prior to the interview and excluded sexual assaults by husbands or boyfriends. A total of 410 unmarried and 258 married women reported experiencing one or more of these sexual violations. Marital status proved to have a dramatic effect on sexual victimization. Among women in the youngest age bracket of 18 to 24, 18 out of 100 unmarried women reported sexual victimization by a stranger, whereas only 7 out of every 100 married women reported sexual victimization. Mesnick and Wilson conclude that their results support the bodyguard hypothesis, although they acknowledge that they have not identified the causal mechanism by which married women are less likely to be raped than comparably aged single women. The lower rate rapes among married than single women might reflect lifestyle differences. Single women might spend more time in public places, such as bars and parties where alcohol is consumed, rather than at home, making them more vulnerable to predatory rapists. It might reflect individual differences in mating strategies, whereby single women might be more likely to pursue short-term matings that place them in contexts where they are exposed to greater danger of sexual coercion. Or it might reflect the deterrent effects of husbands on potential rapists, as the bodyguard hypothesis suggests. The bodyguard hypothesis requires more direct tests. Are women especially likely to choose large, physically imposing men when living in social circumstances that indicate a relatively higher risk of rape? Are women with such men for partners less likely to be raped than women with less formidable partners? Although one study found that women put in crime-prone areas of a city ramp up their preferences for physically formidable mates, this shift appears to reflect a general anti-crime protective reaction rather than a rape-specific defense. A fourth hypothesized anti-rape adaptation is specialized psychological pain, articulated in Thornhill and Palmer's A Natural History of Rape. According to this hypothesis, the psychological trauma that women experience from rape motivates them to avoid similar recurrences in the future. Evidence for this hypothesis comes from a study that purports to show that women who experience the most intense pain and psychological trauma from rape are A. young and fertile women rather than prepubescent girls or postmenopausal women, B. married rather than single women, and C. victims who were vaginally raped rather than orally or anally raped. Furthermore, D. women who experience the most visible signs of physical violence during rape experience the least psychological pain, presumably because they would be less likely to be blamed for or suspected of complicity in the rape. An advocate of the psychological pain hypothesis might have added an additional prediction, E., that women raped by men low in mate value, for example, men who are unattractive and of low socioeconomic status, will experience more psychological trauma than women raped by men higher in mate value, more attractive and higher status men. Regardless of these points of theoretical and empirical contention, one thing is quite clear. Sound scientific evidence is lacking on the specifics of women's defenses against rape. Research is urgently needed on women's anti-rape strategies and their relative effectiveness. Whether or not such strategies ultimately turn out to be specialized, evolved adaptations, or products of more general cognitive and emotional mechanisms. The evolutionary arms race. Conflicts between men and women pervade their interactions on the mating market, in the workplace, and within relationships. These range from conflicts over sexual access in dating couples, to fights over commitment and investment among married couples, to sexual harassment in the workplace, date rape, and warfare rape. Even taking into account the many scientific questions that still remain about how best to explain rape, most sexual conflicts have their origins in men's and women's evolved mating strategies. The strategies pursued by members of one sex often interfere with those of the other sex, as each tries to influence the other toward gender-linked mating goals. Both genders have psychological adaptations, such as anger, sadness, and jealousy, that alert them to interference with their mating strategies. A woman's anger is evoked most intensely in the specific contexts in which a man interferes with her mating strategies. For example, if he acts in condescending, abusive, controlling, or sexually coercive ways toward her, constricting her personal power or freedom of choice. A man's anger is most intensely evoked when a woman interferes with his mating strategies, for example, by spurning his advances, refusing to have sex with him, or hooking up with another man. These battles create spiraling arms races over evolutionary time. For every incremental gain in men's ability to deceive women, women evolve comparable incremental gains in their ability to detect deception. Better abilities to detect deception in turn create the evolutionary conditions for the other sex to develop increasingly subtle forms of deception. For each escalating test that women impose on men to gauge the depth of their commitment, men develop increasingly more elaborate strategies to mimic or minimize commitment. This development in turn favors more refined and subtle tests by women to weed out the pretenders. And for every form of abuse inflicted by one sex on the other evolves methods for circumventing the manipulations. As women evolve better and more sophisticated strategies to achieve their mating goals, men evolve increasingly sophisticated strategies to achieve theirs. Because the mating goals of the sexes interfere with each other within evolutionary delimited domains, there is no evolutionary end to the spiral. Adaptive emotions, such as anger and psychological pain, however, help women and men reduce the cost they incur when someone attempts to interfere with their mating strategies. In the context of dating or marriage, these emotions sometimes lead to the end of the relationship. 8. Breaking up. Women marry believing that their husbands will change. Men marry believing that their wives will not change. They are both wrong. Anonymous. Human mating is rarely a once-in-a-lifetime occurrence. Divorce and remarriage are so common in the United States that nearly 50% of all children do not live with both of their genetic parents. Stepfamilies are rapidly becoming the norm, not the exception. Contrary to some beliefs, this is not a recent phenomenon, nor does it reflect a dramatic decline in family values. Divorce, specifically, and the dissolution of long-term mating relationships more generally, are universal across cultures. Roughly 85% of Americans have experienced at least one breakup of a committed mating relationship. Among the Kung of Botswana, 134 marriages out of 331 recorded ended in divorce, about 40%. Among the Aceh of Paraguay, the average man and woman are married and divorced more than 11 times each by the time they reach the age of 40. People end committed relationships for many reasons. A spouse may start imposing new or larger costs, for example, or a better opportunity for a mate may come along. Staying in a bad relationship can be costly. Lost resources, missed mating opportunities, physical abuse, inadequate care for children, and emotional abuse. These costs all interfere with successful solutions to the critical adaptive problems of survival and reproduction. New mating opportunities, superior resources, better childcare, and better allies are some of the benefits that may flow to people who leave bad relationships. Adaptive problems leading to breakups. Many mates in ancestral times became injured and died before old age. Men, for example, sustained wounds or were killed in combat between warring tribes. The paleontological record reveals fascinating evidence of aggression between men. Pieces of spears and knives have been found lodged in the remains of human rib cages. Injuries to skulls and ribs are found more frequently on male than on female skeletons, revealing that physical combat was primarily a male activity. Intriguingly, more injuries are located on the left sides of skulls and rib cages, suggesting a greater prevalence of right-handed attackers. The earliest known homicide victim in the paleontological record is a Neanderthal man who was stabbed in the chest by a right-hander roughly 50,000 years ago. These highly patterned injuries cannot be explained as accidents. They demonstrate that injury and death at the hands of other people have been recurrent hazards in human evolutionary history. Traditional tribes today do not escape the damage done by male aggression. Among the Aceh, for example, ritual club fights occur only among men, and they often result in permanent disabilities and death. A woman whose husband goes off to a club fight can never be sure that he will return unharmed. Among the Yanomamo, a boy does not achieve full status as a man until he has killed another man. Yanomamo men display their scars proudly, often painting them bright colors to draw attention to them. Men have fought in wars throughout human history, exposing themselves to grave risks. Violence at the hands of other men was not the only way an ancestral man could die. Hunting has always been a male-dominated human enterprise, and ancestral men risked injury, particularly when hunting large game, such as wild boar, bison, or buffalo. Lions, panthers, and tigers roamed the African savanna, inflicting injury or death on the unwary, the unskilled, the imprudent, or the unlucky. Some men accidentally plunged off cliffs or fell from trees. In human ancestral environments, since a woman's husband had a chance of dying first or becoming so seriously injured as to cripple his ability to hunt or to protect her, it would have been highly adaptive for her to assess and encourage alternative mates. Ancestral women never warred and rarely hunted. Women's gathering activities, which yielded 60-80% of the family's food resources, were far less dangerous. Childbirth, however, took its toll. Without modern medical technology, many women failed to survive the dangerous journey of pregnancy and childbirth. A man, left mateless by his wife's death, would have had to start the search and courting process from scratch, unless he had psychological adaptations that anticipated this possibility and caused him to lay the groundwork for securing a replacement. It would have paid for both men and women not to wait until their mate's death to start evaluating potential alternatives. Injury, disease, or the death of a mate were not the only hazards to force ancestral mates to look elsewhere. A woman's husband could lose status within the group, be ostracized, become dominated by a rival male, prove to be a bad father, prove to be infertile, fail as a hunter, start abusing her, initiate affairs, direct resources to other women, or turn out to be sexually impotent. A man's wife could fail at gathering food, mishandle family resources, prove to be a bad mother, prove to be infertile, decline his sexual advances, cheat on him, or get pregnant by another man. Either sex could contract debilitating diseases or become riddled with parasites. Life events sometimes take a terrible toll on a mate full of vitality when initially chosen. Once a selected spouse decreases in value, alternatives become attractive. A mate's decline in value and potential death represented only two of the conditions that might have diverted a person's attention to alternatives. Another critical condition is an increase in one's own desirability, which opens up an array of alternatives that were previously unobtainable. A man, for example, could sometimes dramatically elevate his status by performing an unusually brave deed, such as killing a large animal, defeating another man in combat, or saving someone's child from harm. Sudden increases in a man's status opened up new mating possibilities with younger, more attractive mates, or multiple mates who could make a current mate pale by comparison. Mating options mushroomed for men who managed to boost their status. Because a woman's value as a mate was closely tied with her reproductive value, she usually could not elevate her desirability to the same extent that men could. Nevertheless, women could improve their mate value by acquiring status or power, showing unusual adeptness at dealing with crises, displaying exceptional wisdom, or having sons, daughters, or other kin who achieved elevated positions within the group. These possibilities for change in mating value are still with us today. Another important impetus to break up a mateship was the presence of more desirable alternatives. A desirable mate who had previously been taken could suddenly become available. A previously uninterested person could develop a strong attraction. A member of a neighboring tribe could appear on the scene. And any of these people could be sufficiently desirable to warrant breaking an existing marital bond. In sum, three major general circumstances could have led an ancestral person to leave a long-term mate. When a current mate became less desirable because of a decrease in abilities or resources, or a failure to provide the reproductively relevant resources expected in the initial selection, when the person experienced an increase in his or her own resources or reputation that opened up previously unobtainable mating possibilities, and when compelling alternatives became available. Because these three conditions are likely to have regularly recurred among our ancestors, it is reasonable to expect that humans evolved psychological mechanisms to evaluate the costs and benefits of existing relationships in comparison with the perceived alternatives. These adaptations would have been attuned to changes in the value of a mate, continued to identify and gauge mating alternatives, and led to the pursuit of backup mates or potential replacement mates. Adaptations for breaking up. Ancestral conditions that favored breakups posed recurrent adaptive challenges over human evolutionary history. People who were oblivious to a decrease in their mate's value, who were totally unprepared to find a new mate in the event of their mate's death, or who failed to trade up to a higher quality mate when offered the opportunity, would have been at a tremendous reproductive disadvantage compared with those who perceived and acted on these conditions. It may be disconcerting to acknowledge it, but most people continue to assess outside options while in a committed relationship. Men's banter, when it does not center on sports or work, often revolves around the appearance and sexual availability of women in their social circles. Married women talk as well about which men are attractive, available, and high in status. These discussions accomplish the critical goals of exchanging information and assessing the mating terrain. It pays to monitor alternatives with an eye toward mating opportunities. Those who stick it out with an undesirable mate through thick and thin may receive our admiration, but their kind would not have reproduced as successfully in ancestral times and are not well represented among us today. Men and women evaluate alternative mating possibilities even if they have no immediate intention to act on them. It pays to plan ahead. Mate preferences continue to operate during marriage, being directed not just at comparing the array of potential mates, but at comparing those alternatives with the current mate. Men's preference for young, attractive women does not disappear once they make a long-term commitment to a mate, nor does women's attention to the status and prestige of other men. Indeed, one's mate provides a handy standard for repeated comparisons. Research from my lab, spearheaded by Dan Conroy Beam, discovered that happiness in a mateship is partly determined by the discrepancies between one's partner's mate value and the value of alternative mates in the local environment. People assess how well their mates stack up to the competition and become unhappy if their mates suffer by these comparisons. A decision to keep or get rid of one's mate depends on the outcome of these calculations, which may not be made consciously. A man whose increased status opens up better mating alternatives does not think to himself, "Well, if I leave my current wife, I can increase my reproductive success by mating with younger, more reproductively valuable women." He simply finds other women increasingly attractive and his current relationship less satisfactory. A woman whose mate abuses her does not think to herself, "My reproductive success and that of my children will increase if I leave this cost-inflicting mate." She thinks instead that she had better get herself and her children to safety. Our mateship dissolution adaptations operate without our awareness of the adaptive problems they solve. People typically need a clear, socially acceptable justification for leaving a long-term mate, one that explains the breakup to friends, to family, and even to themselves. They need a public rationale that preserves or minimizes the damage to their social reputation. Although some simply walk away from a relationship, people rarely use this straightforward solution. One effective tactic for expelling a mate, in evolutionary psychological terms, would be to violate the mate's expectations so that the mate no longer desired to maintain the relationship. That is, rather than leaving themselves, some people try to drive their partner to take that step. Ancestral men could withhold resources or give signals that investments were being channeled to other women. Women could decrease a man's certainty of paternity by engaging in infidelities or simply withholding sex from him. Cruel, unkind, inconsiderate, malevolent, harmful, or caustic acts would be effective tactics for expelling a mate for both women and men, because such acts violate the universal preferences held by both of them for mates who are kind and empathic. These tactics have in common the exploitation of existing psychological mechanisms in the other sex, adaptations that alert people to the possibility that they have chosen a mate unwisely, or that their mate has changed in unwanted ways, and that perhaps they should cut their losses. The sex differences in benefits from long-term matings in ancestral times, whereby men's benefits came from monopolizing a woman's reproductive capacity and women's came from monopolizing a man's investments, have profound implications for the causes of separation and divorce. They imply that men and women evaluate changes in their mates over time by very different standards. As a woman ages from 25 to 40, for example, she experiences a rapid decline in her reproductive value, although other components of her mate value may increase and compensate for the loss. During a comparable period, a man may elevate himself in status, and so enjoy an unanticipated avalanche of mating opportunities. Or he may suffer losses and become desperate to keep his current mate. Ancestral men and women broke up, however, for somewhat different reasons that go to the core of the adaptive problems that each gender must solve to mate successfully. A major source of evidence on breaking up comes from the most extensive cross-cultural study ever undertaken on the causes of divorce. The evolutionary anthropologist Laura Betzig analyzed information from 160 societies and identified 43 causes of conjugal dissolution recorded by ethnographers who had lived in the society, or by native informants who resided in each culture. Various constraints, such as the lack of a standard method of gathering data and incomplete data, preclude calculation of the absolute frequencies of the causes of divorce. Nonetheless, the relative frequencies are readily available, and as the number of societies revealing a particular cause of divorce increases, the more likely it is that this cause is a universal cause of divorce. Topping the list of causes of divorce are two key events with direct relevance to reproduction: infidelity and infertility. Infidelity. The most powerful indicator of a man's failure to retain access to a woman's reproductive capacity is her infidelity. The most powerful cue to a woman's failure to retain access to a man's resources is his infidelity. Among the 43 causes of conjugal dissolution, ranging from the absence of male children to sexual neglect, adultery is the single most pervasive cause, being cited in 88 societies. Among those that highlight adultery, there are strong gender differences in prevalence. Although in 25 societies divorce follows from adultery by either partner, 54 societies sanction divorce only if the wife is adulterous. In only 2 societies does divorce occur only following the husband's adultery. Even those 2 societies can hardly be considered exceptions to the sexual double standard, because an unfaithful wife rarely goes without punishment. In both of those cultures, men are known to thrash their wife upon discovery of her infidelity, and occasionally a woman is beaten to death by her husband. Unfaithful wives in these 2 cultures may not be divorced, but neither do they get off lightly. The finding that a woman's infidelity is a more prevalent cause of divorce is especially striking because men are more likely to be unfaithful. Alfred Kinsey, for example, found that 50% of the husbands, but only 26% of the wives surveyed, had been unfaithful. More recent studies find similar gender differences in infidelity rates. The sexual double standard in reactions to infidelity is not confined to American culture or to Western societies, but is observed across the globe. Its pervasiveness stems from three possible sources. First, men have greater power to impose their will, so that women may be forced to tolerate infidelity in their husbands more often than men are forced to tolerate infidelity in their wives. Second, women worldwide may be more forgiving of their husbands' sexual indiscretions, because sexual infidelity per se has been less costly for women than for men over human evolutionary history, unless also accompanied by the diversion of his resources and commitments. Third, women worldwide may more often be forced to tolerate a husband's infidelity because of the prohibitively high costs of divorce, especially if they have children, who curtail women's value on the mating market. For all these reasons, a wife's unfaithfulness more often causes an irrevocable rift that ends in divorce. Knowing that infidelity causes conjugal dissolution, some people may use it intentionally to get out of a bad marriage. In a study of the breakup of mates, we asked 100 men and women which tactics they would use to get out of a bad relationship. Subsequently, a different group of 54 individuals evaluated each tactic for its effectiveness in accomplishing the goal. One common method for getting rid of an unwanted mate was to start an affair, perhaps by sleeping around in an obvious manner, or arranging to be seen with a member of the other gender in some questionable situation. Sometimes an actual affair is not carried out, but is merely alluded to or implied. People use the tactics of flirting with others or telling a partner that they are in love with someone else so that the mate will end the relationship. A related tactic is to express a wish to date other people in order to be sure that the two of them are truly right for each other. A means of gracefully exiting from the relationship through a gradual transition out of commitment. So widely accepted is infidelity as a reason to get rid of a mate that people sometimes exploit it, even if no actual infidelity has occurred. In Truck, for example, if a husband wants to terminate a marriage, he has merely to spread a rumor about his wife's adultery, pretend to believe it, and then leave her in indignation. Apparently, people care about justifying a marital dissolution to their social circles. Pretending that an affair has occurred provides this justification because infidelity is so widely regarded as a compelling reason for breaking up. Infertility. Although ring doves tend to be monogamous, more so than many bird species, they experience a divorce rate of about 25% a season. The major cause of breaking a bond is infertility, the failure of the pair to reproduce. Pairs of ring doves that produce chicks in one breeding season are highly likely to mate again the next season. Those that fail to reproduce in one season seek out alternative mates the next season. Failure to produce children is also a leading cause of divorce for humans. Couples with no children divorce far more often than couples with two or more children. According to a United Nations study of millions of people in 45 societies, 39% of divorces occur when there are no children, 26% when there is only a single child, 19% when there are two, and fewer than 3% when there are four or more. The toll on marriage caused by childlessness occurs regardless of the duration of the marriage. Children strengthen marital bonds, reducing the probability of divorce by creating a powerful commonality of genetic interest between a man and a woman. Failure to produce offspring that transport the genes of both parents into the future deprives a couple of this powerful common bond. Infertility is exceeded only by infidelity as the most frequently cited cause of divorce across societies. In the cross-cultural study of conjugal dissolution, 75 societies reported infertility or sterility as a cause of divorce. Of these, 12 specified the sterility of either the husband or the wife. But sterility, like adultery, appears to be strongly gender-linked. Whereas sterility ascribed exclusively to the man was cited as a cause of divorce in 12 societies, sterility ascribed exclusively to the woman was cited in 30 societies, perhaps reflecting another type of double standard by which women are blamed more than men. In the remaining 21 societies, it is impossible to discern whether or not sterility on the part of the man, the woman, or both was a cause. Not all societies sanction divorce. Where divorce is not authorized, however, provisions are often made for separating a man and woman who do not produce children. In the Andaman Islands off the southern coast of Asia, for example, a marriage is not regarded as consummated until a child is born. Many villages in Japan hold off recording a marriage until long after a wedding, and frequently the marriage is not entered into the family register in the village office until the first child is born. When marriages are not regarded as legally legitimate until children are born, infertility effectively becomes a cause of marital dissolution. Old age is linked with lower fertility. This linkage is stronger in women than in men, but even though sperm quality and concentration per ejaculate declines somewhat with age, men in their 60s, 70s, and 80s can still sire children, and they do. Among the Yanomamo, one particularly productive man had children whose ages spanned 50 years. Among the Tiwi of northern Australia, older men frequently monopolize women 30 or more years younger and sire children with them. Although couples in Western culture tend to be more similar in age than those among the Tiwi and Yanomamo, it is not uncommon for a man to divorce a postmenopausal wife and start a new family with a younger woman. The difference in the reproductive biology of men and women leads to the expectation that older age in a wife will lead to divorce more often than older age in a husband. Although the cross-cultural study on conjugal dissolution did not find old age to be a frequently cited cause of divorce, it was cited in 8 societies studied, and in all 8, it was the old age of the woman, never the man, that caused divorce. When men divorce, they almost invariably marry younger women. In evolutionary terms, it makes perfect sense that infertility and infidelity are the most prevalent causes of divorce worldwide. Both represent the strongest and most direct failures to deliver the reproductive resources that provide the evolutionary raison d'être for long-term mating. People do not consciously calculate that their fitness suffers from these events. Rather, infidelity and infertility are adaptive problems that exerted selection pressure on human ancestors for a psychology attuned to reproductive failures. Just as having sex tends to lead to the production of babies, even though the people involved may have no awareness of the reproductive logic involved, so anger leads a person to leave an unfaithful or infertile mate, with no conscious articulation of the underlying adaptive logic being required. The fact that couples who are childless by choice are nonetheless devastated by infidelity shows that our psychological mechanisms continue to operate in modern contexts, even those far removed from the selection pressures that gave rise to them. Sexual withdrawal. A wife who refuses to have sex with her husband is effectively depriving him of access to her reproductive value, although neither mate necessarily thinks about it in these terms. Since sex, throughout human evolutionary history, has been necessary for reproduction, depriving a man of sex may eliminate the reproductive dividends on the investment that he has expended in obtaining his wife. It may also signal that she is allocating her sexuality to another man. Men have evolved psychological adaptations that alert them to this form of interference with their sexual strategies. In the cross-cultural study on conjugal dissolution, 12 societies identified the refusal to have sex as a cause of conjugal dissolution. In all these societies, the cause was attributed exclusively to the wife's refusal, not the husband's. My lab's study of the breakup of mates also found sexual refusal to be a major tactic for getting rid of unwanted mates. Women described their tactics for breaking up variously as refusing to have physical contact with their mate, becoming cold and distant sexually, refusing to let her mate touch her body, and declining sexual requests. These tactics were employed almost exclusively by women. The success of this tactic is illustrated by one woman's account in the study on the breakup of mates. She complained to a friend that her repeated attempts to break off with her husband had failed. She wanted advice. Further discussion revealed that although she seriously wanted to get rid of her husband, she never had refused his sexual advances. Her friend suggested that she try it. A week later, she reported that her husband had become enraged at her sexual refusal and, after 2 days, had packed his bags and left. They were divorced shortly thereafter. If women give sex to get love and men give love to get sex, then depriving a man of sex may be a reliable way to stop his love and hasten his departure. Lack of economic support. A man's ability and willingness to provide a woman with resources are central to his mate value, central to her selection of him as a partner, central to the tactics that men use to attract mates, and central to the tactics that men use to retain mates. In evolutionary terms, a man's failure to provide resources to his wife and her children should, therefore, have been a major gender-linked cause of breakups. Men who are unable or unwilling to supply these resources fail to fulfill a key criterion on which women initially select them. Provisioning failure by men is a cause of divorce worldwide. In the cross-cultural study on conjugal dissolution, 20 societies cited inadequate economic support as a cause of divorce. 4 cited inadequate housing, 3 cited inadequate food, and 4 cited inadequate clothing. All these causes were ascribed solely and exclusively to men. In no society did a woman's failure to provide resources constitute grounds for divorce. The seriousness of a man's lack of economic provision is illustrated by the report of a woman in her late 20s who participated in a study of marital separation. "My husband lost a series of jobs and was very depressed. He just couldn't keep a job. He had a job for a couple of years and that ended. And then he had another for a year, and that ended. And then he had another. And then he was really depressed, and he saw a social worker, but it didn't seem to be helping, and he was sleeping a lot. And I think one day I just came to the end of the line with his sleeping. I think I went out one night and came back, and he hadn't even been able to get out of bed to put the children to bed. I left them watching television, and there they were when I came back. The next day I asked him to leave, very forcefully." In contemporary America, women who make more money than their husbands tend to leave them. One study found that the divorce rate among American couples in which the woman earns more than her husband is 50% higher than among couples in which the husband earns more than his wife. Men whose wives' careers blossom sometimes express resentment. In a study on the causes of divorce among women, one woman noted that her husband hated that I earned more than he did. It made him feel less than a man. Women also resent husbands who lack ambition. Another woman noted, "I worked full-time while he worked part-time and drank full-time. Eventually I realized I wanted more help getting where I'm going." Women eject men who do not fulfill their preference for a mate who provides resources, especially when they can earn more. Conflict among multiple wives. Polygyny is a widespread practice across cultures. An analysis of 853 cultures revealed that 83% of them permitted polygyny. In some West African societies, 25% of all older men have two or more wives simultaneously. Even in cultures in which polygyny is not allowed legally, it sometimes occurs. One study estimated that there are 25,000 to 35,000 polygynous marriages in the United States, mostly in Western states. Another study of 437 financially successful American men found that some maintained 2 separate families, each unknown to the other. From a woman's perspective, a major drawback of her husband taking additional wives is that resources channeled to another wife and her children are denied to her and her children. Although co-wives may derive significant benefits from one another's presence, such as help with raising children, often one wife's gain is another wife's loss. The cross-cultural study on conjugal dissolution found polygyny to be a cause for divorce in 25 societies. largely because of conflict among the man's co-wives. Conflict among co-wives may have been an adaptive problem that polygynous men in ancestral times had to solve to maintain control over their wives. The problem was how to keep all wives happy so that none left.